Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hello! You have once again stumbled upon the three questions. I'm Andy Richter, and my guest here today is somebody that I've known for a very, very long time. We've never liked each other much. It's always been stressful. It's always been tense.
I like you.
Oh shit! I thought it was mutual. Ladies and gents, it's Jerry Minor. The very, very funny Jerry Minor. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. So, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a long time.
Yeah, it's been a little bit.
It has been.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. What are you up to these days?
I am doing a play right now, a musical that's about Michael Jackson's glove.
Did you write it? Or
I did not write it. Another fellow wrote it, and he was after me for a couple of years to do this.
Yeah.
And then he got in contact with me a couple of years and goes, hey, do you want to do this play? And I'm like, oh, and then I listened to the music. It's a musical. And really liked it. And so I'm like, hey, if you want to do that play, I'd still want to do it. And then a documentary came out on HBO, and I'm like, well, they won't be doing that play.
Yeah, yeah.
But the play doesn't really deal with that thing. It's mostly his early life, and it's a comedy. Like I said, it's about his glove. So it's like Sid and Marty Krofft, in it.
It's absurd enough that you don't have to worry too much about the.
You got it.
The icky part.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I find he's such a divisive character now because it's. African American people are really, really protective of him. A lot of people are refuse to believe, like it's like a religion or something. And it's kind of there's a lot of smoke there.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess there's got to be some fire because,
Yeah, well, and there was also the kind of defiance that he had. I mean, we saw it, in the interview of hey, is this normal? And I'm like, of course it's normal,
Right.
But, he also had this life of doing whatever he wanted, enough money to do whatever he wanted. So it's such a weird, and I've met so many people that have been involved with him. I know people that slept in the bed with him, they're people that we work with now.
Right.
So it's just a mix of a mess.
Yeah. It is pretty, it's like one of the most unique stories of just the power of fame and genius combined, not just fame, but also he was a genius. Mm-hmm. So I honestly don't know. I can't think of anybody that people are so protective of, even as much as weird, crazy shit that happened. Mm-hmm. And I do think that because there's a sympathy towards, what it's like to be a child star, have an abusive parent, be an African American in today's world, and also I think be gay. I just think he was just gay,
That's you pretty much deal the whole story of what this play is about.
Yeah. Right? Oh, really?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Because I can't remember who I was talking to, but it was somebody, it was a older homosexual who knew him and said, like, he was just gay. He just had such a fucking weird life that, like, mm-hmm. it just came out in such a weird permutation, you know?
But. Yeah, you know, we explore a little bit of that. You know, the writer wanted me to do it because he knew about my background. I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, and
yeah,
and that's
oh, what we'll talk family. About that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he wanted me to do it because I knew this experience, and you know, when I was a kid, and we knew about him, and you know, that was always a rumor. You know, I lived in Michigan, and obviously he was in California, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, it was like, oh. He says he's a Jehovah's Witness, but I didn't believe it because, you know, he was like outperforming and doing
right,
stuff,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so later on, a story came out, you know, that he was, and then he left. But the writer wanted me to do it just because he thought how much of like that teaching affected him in his later life, and
yeah.
not maybe wanting to admit he was gay or even suppressing his sexuality, you know, and all. And that was something that I could bring to him and go, yeah, well, I can show you the literature that, you know, I was given when I was a kid and
yeah, yeah.
and stuff like that. So I don't know how much it affected him later on, but
right.
I know how it affected people that I was around.
And, yeah, you
know,
yeah.
And a lot, you know, I saw a lot of people who actually would join that organization because they were trying to suppress their sexuality.
Yeah.
You know, I saw it in my own family. So
yeah, yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me that he took on some of that, you know, some of that thinking, and at least it was in his family.
Yeah.
Of you know, that there's just no way that I could be gay or,
right.
or you know, maybe even sexual too, you know,
yeah, yeah.
In any way.
Right.
You know, that's what I learned, like any kind of sexuality outside of marriage. And outside of trying to make babies is bad. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I think too, I mean, just that stunted childhood, like, you know, no childhood, that fucks with you. You know, it's mm-hmm. got it causes some. Was Prince a witness too?
He was later on in life. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
yeah.
That's weird
one.
To be a late onset witness, you know? I think
yeah.
that's. Although, you know what? I have cousins mm-hmm. that in their, I don't know, 30s became witnesses, mm-hmm. you know, and it just, you know, it seems like it's one of those ones that's so rigid mm-hmm. that for people that are looking for just some kind of vessel to hold them
yeah.
and to give them a reason to just, I don't know, they're looking for like a strict parent or something, you know?
That says, well, we all are in a way, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And that says a lot. And then also, I mean, you know, you can kind of get trapped in it too, you know?
Yeah,
you get along and you start studying, you start doing these things, you start learning things, and then all of a sudden you start believing in it. And it's just almost like a social, you know, thing where you go, well, I have to do this, you know?
Yeah,
It's really weird. And I grew up in it, which is different, but I mean, I saw people, I helped people in, you know, in that way of like, all of a sudden you're in now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
So you're from Flint, Michigan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, but you weren't born there, right?
I was born in Memphis, but I went there when we moved.
When you were tiny.
Was, like, really
yeah.
Yeah.
And your folks were witnesses. Were they born witnesses?
My mom
yeah.
was. My dad was. My mom and dad got divorced early on, so I don't remember, but
yeah.
My mom became a witness. She was really into religion, it seemed like. And then when I was around 6 or 7 years old, she started studying with the witnesses. They came to our house.
Yeah.
But I also had an aunt who lived in Memphis
mm-hmm.
who was one. And so my mom was kind of familiar with the whole organization and stuff.
So it was when you were seven. It wasn't like mm-hmm. it was always there.
No, I do remember us becoming and going, starting to go to the meetings and stuff like that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And do you question it at all when you're that little? I mean, the strictness of it and the no celebrating birthdays and Christmas and all that kind of thing. Is that, you know?
I did.
Because that shit's got to be weird to a kid.
That
you know?
Was weird to me. Yeah. And, you know, and it was starting to be like I wanted to be a Cub Scout, and I didn't know that there was a rule against Cub Scouts because it's a Christian organization,
right.
and they don't, you know, fellowship with other Christians. Or
right. There's only one way, yeah.
There's only one way. So
yeah.
I didn't understand, like, well, why can't I be a Cub Scout? And they go, like, well, we have arts and crafts down here. And I'm like, there's no arts and crafts here. This is I'm just listening to somebody, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was always an alternative, like, oh, no, you don't want to play football. You want to, like, you know, go house to house and door to door.
Yeah, so watchtowers.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was weird to me as a kid.
Yeah.
And
so you couldn't play sports because they, like, frowned upon it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, any kind of like extracurricular activity. I had to even like my mom was. I used to say my joke is my mom was Jehovah's key witness. She was really into it.
Star witness. Yes.
So she like she took me out of marching band.
Wow.
And there were other witnesses that were into marching band. And they stayed, and I'm like, what? They get to?
Yeah,
I don't,
yeah, yeah.
What, why do I?
That's such like a classic cult.
Yeah, deal, you know? I know.
Like the isolation thing, you know, it's like it's so strange. Mm-hmm.
Well, was there aspects of it that you liked that you found sort of, I imagine like just anything, because, you know, I went to church as a kid and I never really believed. I've always kind of just naturally been agnostic just because like as a kid, I just was like, wait, if I step on a bug, does that bug go to heaven? You know? And I think even as a kid, I thought like, how can one just be right?
Right.
You know, they're all different, you know? Mm-hmm. I went to church. It's a United Church of Christ, which is a pretty liberal church. Mm-hmm. And we had a really great minister that was very charismatic, and I really liked him. And so I was in church, like I say, not believing, but just because I liked sort of it was like a philosophical place. Mm-hmm. And it was – and, you know, and it was – a lot of my friends went. And so it was like a sense of community. And is that sort of one of the things that kind of kept you going or
– I guess that – well, what kept me going is because I had to. You know?
Yeah.
I was afraid I was going to die in Armageddon. So right. That's it.
Oops.
You know, because my dad, you know, divorced, and he goes to a church, and he goes to an AME church. Uh-huh. And there it's the same kind of thing. It's a lot more about the community. They do a lot of like outreach and stuff like that. And I have no problem with that church. I love going. And going with them. I think some of the good things that I got from it, I think, are public speaking.
Yeah,
because I was trained to be a public speaker.
To get up and
talk to people.
Yeah.
And also talking to people.
Oh, right, right.
You know,
sure.
So I feel
that
like
it's true. That's like performance, mm-hmm. you know, that is performance because, yeah.
And I definitely felt comfortable. I mean, the first thing I did when I left was I started performing, you know, because I didn't know how to relate to people other than being a class clown at school and getting up in front of talking, you know, and talking in front of people. So I think the week that I left the church, I was.
At what age?
20?
Yeah.
I was up in front of an audience like that week. I'm like, well, I got to do something. And
doing stand-up?
Trying to do stand-up.
Wow, yeah. Wow.
Trying
to. Now, was being funny a problem when you were in the witnesses? You
know, it was something that I could do because I couldn't like play sports and I couldn't do a lot of like extracurricular activities. I was allowed to do quiz bowl my senior year, which I think if I'd have gone a little bit longer, they would have taken me out of that too.
Yeah.
But quizzing.
Too much knowledge.
There was a thing of people thought that Jehovah's Witnesses were dumb because they don't go to college and they discourage kids seeking a higher education. And this competition was good.
It's also classic. And
I know. Don't learn anything.
Yeah. It's like one of the things I love about Scientology is like that they're like so anti-psychiatry and mental health professionals because it's like – I don't know. It's just like it's like you know, mice being against cats, you know, it's just like, you know, I mean, cause it's like the thing that will help you realize how fucked up this is like, nah, stay away from that. You don't want mental health.
It's the most evil thing.
Yeah.
Well, also because, you know, L. Ron Hubbard, his whole system, he took that to the American Psychiatry Association early on, and they told him, get out of here.
Yeah.
And so that started that.
Right.
And a lot of things are like that, too. You know, I had no idea that a lot of the things that Jehovah's Witnesses have gotten into their practices are because the early leader, like, they don't have facial hair, at least in the United States.
Yeah.
And it was because the second leader, who was a lot of times like, that's the guy who really, like, turns it up.
Yeah.
Didn't want people to have facial hair because the first leader had it.
Wow.
And that's the only reason. Because I was always like, why can't I have a beard?
When did it start? What?
It started, Charles Russell started it in the, around the turn of the century, so like the late 1800s.
Yeah.
And then the second guy, it was like a schism.
Yeah.
It still is. So yeah. the group that the first guy started still is going.
Oh, really?
Has their own little thing, very small.
Yeah.
And the second guy made it big. He turned them into Jehovah's Witnesses. He came up with that name. They were just called Bible students. And that was after the turn of the century, like around the, between the 1915 and 1920.
Yeah. There. So I like to think that, the first Bible students are all now just have huge beards. Even the women, just big beards. We'll show you. So when you're funny, are they like, are you funny at church?
No.
Or do you don't call it church? Do you call it church? Or
no, they just go to meetings.
Meetings,
You know, they call the church the congregation, so the people that gather there. But the building they call Kingdom Hall.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And you're not, you can't really be funny there.
No, I don't think there's that much opportunity to be funny.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. But I mean, are you, were you funny when you were passing out watchtowers ever?
No, just at school. That was just to relate to normal people.
Right.
Know? So, yeah, I mean, if you can't do anything else,
right.
Class clown.
Were you a wise ass too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Probably it was all so bottled up.
You go to school. I can get it all out. Oh,
right.
Man, I would think about like, oh, it's Friday. I got like Saturday and Sunday to come up with some new bits, some things to tease people with, you know. And then by Monday, I was ready to go.
Yeah. You know? I wouldn't say I was class clown, but I was like class wise ass. Mm-hmm. Like I was, and I mean,
yeah.
And I get, you know, like, because too, it was like in high school, like teachers that were just, I just knew were dumber than
me. Yes, of course.
I just fucking would roast them until they get mad. Yeah. And in retrospect, I look back on it, and it's just because I was so frustrated at my own lack of power in my life.
And was that in general? Or just, you mean just as a child growing up, you just like, oh, I don't have enough power?
It was as a child. It was like, you know, divorces and moving and just feeling like, you know, and just like there was just all these different things that happened to me that just, you know, and even like when my mom remarried, because she wanted to have more kids, like she changed. It was such a, it was between second and third grade. And she wanted, and because my dad didn't have any money. And her new husband had a you know thriving plumbing business, and so she wanted us to be she wanted him to adopt us, so he became our legal father, and my dad signed off on it because he felt like he couldn't support us and he didn't support us, but she wanted to have more kids, so she wanted us all to have the same last name, so I was. Richter is my dad's name, was my born name, but her second husband was named Swanson. And she had it changed our names when he adopted us to Swanson. So at whatever that is, second grade, when I was 7, 8 years old, I got a new last name.
Yeah, right. Like, what am I
doing? Yeah. It's like, and it just was like, oh, you're getting a new last name. And it was funny too, because I switched schools. We moved to a different town.
And you said you were born in Michigan and then you moved to?
Yeah, Michigan for just a minute.
Okay.
And then I lived in Indiana for a little bit, but I mean, mostly in Illinois, mostly 70 miles west of Chicago in kind of a small town. And when my folks divorced, we moved back in with my grandparents, and that was like the ancestral home in Yorkville, Illinois. But it was funny because since I changed schools, I in my mind, and, you know, at the time I thought, I don't like the way Andy Swanson sounds. And my full name is Paul Andrew Richter. And my mom called me Andrew for some reason. And my older brother goes by his middle name, too. It's just some weird thing, which actually became really handy with bill collectors.
You know, no, he's not here. Because
they call for Paul, and I'd be like, this is his roommate, Glenn. Whenever we called for Paul, I'd be like, he's not here.
Yeah.
But I decided Paul Swanson sounded better. So when I went to a new school, I became Paul Swanson. And in retrospect, it was such like – a desperate attempt to reclaim some kind of control over this. Like, you're going to change my name. Well, I'm going to have some say in it, and I'm going to change it too. And then after 2 years, my grandfather died, and my grandma couldn't keep up this big house, so we moved back into their house and added on to it. And I moved back to school, and I came back, and I'm like, I'm Paul Swanson, and all these kids that I've been to second grade were like, no, you're not. You're Andy. And I'm like, no, all right, I'm Andy. Because I was Andy at home anyway, you know. So I was like, all right, I'm Andy. So then I was Andy Swanson until I was 18, 19 years old. And then I changed it. My dad asked me to change it back, and I did. I went through the legal process of changing it back, which I'm happy to do. I mean, I don't really give a shit one way or the other, but, you know, name's a name.
But anyway, were you funny then?
Yeah. And I mean, and I was a smart ass, but just like, and it was fun, and there were, and I mean, and you can use it too. Like, teachers are mad at you, and if you make them laugh, there were so many times when a teacher would be mad at me and be yelling at me, and I'd say something that would make them laugh, and you could just, so fucking, it's such a magic trick to, like, turn an adult, like, to turn off their anger and fucking, like, to control them, you know, manipulate an adult. It was so thrilling, you know. But I didn't think about, I didn't think about, did you think about doing it professionally?
No.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Yeah. No. Not, it not wasn't just... until 19, I mean, when you started to do stand-up, had it in your mind, or was it just?
No.
No.
I thought, you know, that was the stand-up boom, you know, it was like 80s.
And you're still in Detroit, right?
Yeah. Still in Flint. Yeah. And, you know, there wasn't that much comedy around town, but there people were doing it like in Detroit. And so the first thing I started doing is first I went to like the local clubs and like, hey, you know, while these people are dancing, I go up to the DJ and it's like, hey, can I tell some jokes?
Oh my God, really?
I did that.
Holy shit, that's bold.
The first time I did stand up, I went with a friend of mine. I'm like, I think I'm going to try it at this, at the club. Because they say they do it at comedy clubs, right? That's a club.
Yeah.
So I went up to the DJ and I said, hey, can I tell some jokes? And I could see the DJ's like, oh, you want to tell? Yeah. And he stops the music like, hey, everybody, this guy wants to tell jokes. And like just the booze.
Oh, of course.
I didn't get two words out. And there's a guy that was like standing right in my face going, sit down! Sit down! Screaming.
Such a bad idea.
So then I started like looking. I'm like, okay, maybe I should look in the phone book at like places that actually do comedy. And
there's
a couple of places like in Detroit. And so I drove down there and asked them, you know, if I could get up. And, you know, they'd be like, that's called showcasing.
Yeah.
And I started. That's the way I started.
Yeah. I do want to backtrack just one second.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the decision process of getting out of the Jehovah's Witnesses, like what? How did that evolve? When did you first start to feel like I gotta get out of this?
Well, I flipped out and got kicked out.
Oh, really?
that wasn't meant to rhyme. I'm not Nipsey Russell here.
I wish you were. Oh, I wish you were.
I got kicked out. I just had a night where I went and did the most debaucherous things that I could think of, and then was guilty about it, and went right to the elders, what they call them, and told them. And I kept having these problems, and was just like, I just don't know what's happening. And I really think that what I wanted was out.
Yeah.
I was still living with my mom, couldn't figure out a way to get out. You know, all my friends are going to college, you know, that weren't Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right.
They're going places.
Did you have a job?
I did have a job, yeah. I was working at night. And also my neighborhood had turned from, you know, like a regular neighborhood that was kind of mixed, where we had white and black people, to crack central.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like—
What year is this about?
88, 89.
Yeah.
There's like, you know, prostitutes turning tricks in front of my house. I'm finally counting. There's murders, you know.
It
just completely changed. And, you know, all this stuff is around me. Now, I don't know. I'm thinking that this is just the world as in general. I don't know that, like, no, that's your neighborhood. That's happening. And so I flipped out, had sex, did drugs all the same night, and went and told.
Now that's, you know, kudos. that you can just, you know, people work hard at that shit. You just, you know.
Happens all the time. Happens all the time. You know, it's just like when Scientology, when people blow, what they call blow.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
They just like take off.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. That's why they like follow each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People just flip out and be like, I can't do this anymore. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? And
I gotta get high and fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for me, I thought like that's what people do. That's what normal people do.
Yeah,
so I just want to do what normal people. I didn't know that, like, no, not everybody does that.
Right,
it took
right.
me a few years after leaving to go like, I go like, okay, well, like, when's the orgy starting? When's,
right,
and
right.
people are like, no, that's not what normal people do.
Yeah, extremes to extremes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, and part of that, too, was that I ended up getting kicked out, which is what they call disfellowshipping. And most people take that as just a term, like a jail term or, you know, a punishment term where you get kicked out for a year, 2 years or whatever. You show up at the meetings. Nobody talks to you. And you kind of work your way back in. You write a letter and you get back in. I had no idea how the process actually went until I was actually kicked out, which I was surprised by. I was actually surprised I kicked out because I confessed. I said everything. And I was always told, as long as you go and tell what you did and you confess, they'll work with you. And I did. And they were like, yeah, you're out. So you're not going to be able to talk to your mom, your friends, anybody that you know, because pretty much I'd made that my only social circle.
Wow.
At that point. And I didn't know that nobody, I thought that at least the elders, or the older people would talk to me and work with me because I'm like, hey, I'm having a hard time.
And because that's what they told you too.
Yeah, yeah. We'll work with you. And it was like, I'm having a hard time. I just want to sin all the time. And I need somebody to work with me. And they're like, well, your work is that nobody's going to talk to you for a year.
Wow.
And that's it. And that automatically, it just fell like a house of cards. I was just like, this isn't right.
Yeah.
And I started thinking like Jim Jones had happened not too long before that. And I went, you know, if they're going to do this. And my mom, actually, I was living with my mom and she kicked me out of the house. I had nowhere to go. I had my dad, which was a good thing, but a lot of kids don't.
Yeah, yeah. Was he in Flint?
He was in Flint. Yeah. He was in town. And I kind of, you know, our relationship had waned because I was so much into Jehovah's Witnesses. You know? So I wasn't spending as much time, but I'm so happy that I had him and my stepmom and my stepbrother and sister who, you know, helped me out. And I went to college and
there was open arms to come.
Open arms.
That's
come,
great.
You know, went to school and had no idea that that was available to me.
Right.
You know, and it was still
that's
a
really
hard
nice,
transition.
But shit, if you didn't have that, it could have been terrible.
I talk to people all the time who don't have that.
Yeah.
Like, where am I going to go? I want to leave this religion. It's just kids who, you know, come to a realization that they don't want to do this anymore, but what are they going to do?
Yeah.
And I think for me, that's part of what I did was there was just a part of me that just said, you got to get out of this. And no matter what it takes, get out.
Yeah.
And so I think that was the whole night that I did that. And just me not wanting to admit that to myself.
Right.
Because it was just so easy after I saw the way that they treated me. I'm like,
yeah.
This isn't right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that the first time you had sex on that blowout? Wow. Wow, you really.
And I should say, too, it wasn't really like real sex. Like, it was like barely, I hadn't done anything. So,
right.
But to me, it was like, oh, I had sex. Just it's like somebody barely touched me, you know?
Right.
But I did do drugs, though.
Yeah. Well, yo, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, of course. I mean, I'm not saying you're a nerd.
And I did the drugs because I'm like, well, they're here. So, I might as well, like, go live it all up.
Right, right. Yo, sure. If you're going to sin, you might as well, yeah.
Yeah, don't do that, kids.
Yeah. Might as well lay with beasts.
You know? Yes,
why not?
I would have. That's what we were doing, right?
Got any goats?
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I need the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a growing? So you start then doing comedy, you start doing stand-up. And but you eventually you get into there's a second city in Detroit that you did too.
Yeah, I was doing stand up and I just started to work with a sketch group because I kind of like that was what I wanted to gravitate toward anyway. You know,
yeah, yeah.
So many stand ups then at that point. But I started to
it's
like
more fun too.
Yeah,
I like being on stage with other people. I don't like being on stage alone too much.
I like doing characters. I like, and another thing is I wanted to get outside of myself and be different people, you know, and I could do that a little bit in stand up, but it was hard, you know, it's hard, you know, like now I'm going to do this guy, you know, like, but I found a group of guys that I started doing these sketches with at a club, the Chaplains in Detroit. And we got a night actually for a while, and so we were doing that. And then they announced they were going to open up a second city in Detroit. And
wow!
I'm like, oh, I want to do that, and so I auditioned. And I had actually the group that I was working with, we got together from a lady who was a doctor in Detroit, and she would take classes in Chicago. She was rich. Her husband played for the Tigers, Detroit Tigers. So she had enough money to go. She would fly to Chicago on the weekends and take classes.
And bring back her knowledge.
And bring back her knowledge. And she brought this, and she's like, I want to do a show like they're doing this thing called Second City. And so the guys in my group, we entered and we got into her show because she's like, I want these sketch performers.
Yeah.
And she brought us to Chicago to watch a show.
Oh, wow.
And so when they announced that they were going to open one in Detroit, I'm like, oh, great. Now I don't have to move to Chicago. It's great. Because I was thinking about moving at that point. Mm-hmm. And it was between going
and
to Chicago.
And you're 20, 21 at this point?
At that point, yeah. 22, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd gotten some, you know, some brochures from Chicago, and then I also found out about the Groundlings here in L.A. And I was going to do one or the other.
Yeah.
And then they said, oh, we're going to have one in Detroit. So I auditioned and got in.
And how long were you there?
Second City. Well, I was in Detroit for a year.
Yeah.
And then I went to Chicago.
Oh, you just... What was that decision? Just like you wanted the real deal, you know?
Kinda? SNL, nobody would come and watch us. Oh. So SNL wouldn't. They were like, no, can we get a flight out the same night? And they're like, no. And they're like, well, then we're not coming to watch anybody there.
Oh.
So I was like, well, I think I need to go to Chicago, do a show in Chicago.
Was it the same in that it had a school attached?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but did you go through classes or were you on stage right away because you had already?
They picked a cast and then they put us through classes, so they had some people come from Chicago, and then we actually went to Chicago for a little while too.
Yeah,
and we did what people would do in their levels. We did that every day.
We
were going to class like 5 days a week.
Wow,
before the show opened.
Wow, wow. And how long were you in Chicago? Did you like? Was it an easy transfer? Like, did you?
It was. I gotten to know a lot of people. There were a few people at that point who'd come from Chicago and joined our cast in Detroit, so I knew a few people. Adam McKay and a bunch of these guys came down one night and improvised with us. And so
in Detroit?
In Detroit, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I knew all those guys. And so when I moved to Chicago, Adam was moving to New York right at the same time.
Yeah.
So I took his apartment.
Oh.
And I lived in that apartment. So it just you know, everything worked out.
Right.
At that point, I was married. And so I was going back and forth. I was doing shows in Chicago. Like Thursday through Sunday, and then I would go live my life in Michigan.
Oh, wow. Your wife was still there, yeah.
Yeah, I did that for a year.
Wow.
And she put up with that for a year.
Wow, wow. And then it was done, or?
She didn't want to put up with
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I got married like right, almost a year after I left the Jehovah's Witnesses, which is probably the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, probably.
But I didn't want to sin anymore. I still had a little bit of
that. That's what I was just going to ask. Mm-hmm. I wondered if it was like a hangover of guilt and that you like,
nobody told me like, hey, you don't have to be married.
Right.
Like, no, I
But God, God really doesn't give a shit. Yeah.
I was really trying to live that lifestyle. My whole thing was like, well, that is wrong, but what I learned was right. You know, so I learned what I thought was the Bible and the right way to live. And I'm still going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just not going to go to that church or whatever.
Right. Right. So,
So, you didn't have kids with your first wife or anything, did you?
No, we did have a stepdaughter.
Oh, you did have a stepdaughter.
Yeah, but yeah, my wife then was I married a woman that was much older than me.
Oh, so really?
I got married when I was 21, and I think she was 33.
Wow.
So she had a daughter that was almost a teenager.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
Married, so
is that?
Yeah. So I was closer to my daughter's age than my wife.
Was it? Oh my God, that's weird. Was it like a misplaced mother thing?
Yeah. There was many times where I'd wake up and go, "Mom, I mean, honey."
Oh, that is weird. What was your? I guess I gotta ask about what was your relationship with your mom like after you left?
I didn't talk to her, and pretty much.
And has that continued, or?
She just died not too long ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That continued all the way up until then. The first time I talked to her, there was a couple of times I talked to her. I talked to her once after I was in SNL.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be a few times where I'd like call her and say, "Hey, you know, I still love you. I'm still here." And then that would be the end of the conversation. No, nothing deep. What are you doing? Where are you living? None of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then before she died, I found some relatives. Some relatives found me and told me that she was sick. She had ALS.
Uh-huh.
And so she was starting to deteriorate at that point. And so we did talk a little bit, you know,
yeah.
She found out she had a grandson and all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
So we were able to reconnect a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see her before she passed?
No. Oh. No. Never made it out there.
Wow. And she still, it was up in Flint?
She had moved, actually. I didn't know where she was.
Oh, wow.
It had been that long. It had been 20 years, pretty much, since I talked to her. And at all.
Yeah,
And even in those conversations, none of those conversations when I did talk to her were meaningful.
Yeah, yeah.
And like I said, she didn't contact me. I had other relatives who weren't Jehovah's Witnesses contact me and say, "Hey, maybe you should contact your mom." And I was surprised that she even actually talked to me then.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like a silly question, I guess, but like, is that hard or do you get used to it after a while? I mean, or is there always kind of this missing thing?
Oh, I mean, it was always this missing thing. I think I just, you know, I had other parents.
Yeah.
So it kind of like my stepmom.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even when we did a Mother's Day special on SNL and my stepmom came.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I'd grown up with them almost as much. You know, I was on my dad at my dad's house on the weekends. She became my mom.
Yeah.
And but there was still always a hole of like there was the person that I spent all my time or most of my time with.
Yeah.
You know, from until I was a teenager.
Yeah, yeah.
And we really did have a close relationship, and I knew more about her, and she knew more about me than anybody.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the reasons why I started. I really wanted to be on television because I always wanted to go like, "Hey, I'm doing okay, and you can
see
me."
Right, right, right. Oh, wow.
So now I'm like, well, what do I do now? There's nobody to watch. I should find another career now.
You know what? You should do a musical about Michael Jackson's glove. Because, you know, she probably wouldn't approve. Like, now's your chance. Yeah, it is weird because I haven't talked to my dad in years. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, the relationship kind of turned toxic and it was it just made sense to not keep in contact. Mm-hmm. And it is weird how, like, I mean, because, yeah, there's definitely kind of – and, I mean, you know, my folks divorced when I was four.
Mm-hmm.
So – and I've said this on here too that, like, he wasn't really present. So, like, mm-hmm. I didn't have, like, a real male role model that was really present. I mean, I had an uncle sort of and I would sort of glom on to different kind of male role models. Mm-hmm. But mostly it was just like I was just surrounded by women.
Mm-hmm.
But it is weird how kind of like there's still there's this efficiency that happens, mm-hmm. you know, where it's kind of like it does bother me that I don't talk to him. But then
you move on.
And you know, and you get like updates
mm-hmm.
that tell you like, well, okay, yeah, it's
still the same way.
Yeah.
Yep. That's the way it was for me too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I call and go like, eh. It's
and
the
I
same
wish
way.
It weren't, but it, you know, it's like, it just feels like I would just be going back to the same thing that, you know, the same sort of toxicity that, mm-hmm. that, you know, fucked it up in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, It's just, you know, it's sad and it's weird and it, you know, but, you know.
Well, you have kids and so.
I do.
That
and that's why I say, like being a dad, I've said this before in here. I'm a mom. I know how to mom more than I mean, mm-hmm. There is sort of, I think, like just preternatural differences between the way males react to children and females react to children. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, I'm not a mom, mm-hmm. but I do like my love for my kids isn't tossing a ball around the yard. It's cooking, uh-huh. I do have kids I think I'm a pretty good dad. Yeah.
I know you are.
Yeah. And I mean, but it's also, you know, I mean, I worked at it, but it's also just part of the work of working on myself.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to be a good dad, you got to, you know, you can't avoid your own bullshit. You got to figure that out before you can be a good anything.
Well, you know that. And that's the thing is like, I'm sure that that's applied, you know, your experience is applied to like how much of a father you are now, what kind of father you are. I mean, that's exactly the way it is with me.
Yeah. How old is yours? Is it a boy?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Two. Wow.
Yeah. It took me a while.
Wow. that's gotta be exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still an exhausting phase.
Yeah. Yeah. How old are you, may I ask?
52.
52. Yeah. Jesus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm 53. Mm-hmm. A 2-year-old at this age.
I know. Everybody's like, whoa. I've happily forgot about. I ask people about stuff and they're like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. You don't get any sleep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I forgot about it on purpose.
I forget. Yeah. I definitely. You're, you know, like there's like a shark brain, mm-hmm. especially with children. Because if you hold on to how fucking hard it is, you'll only have one because it's really, you know, it's really just like, you gotta, and also you just gotta, you know, you gotta be ready to just give it
dive
up.
Into it.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta just be ready to like, it isn't about me, you know, like boo hoo, buy me, you know? So, what gets you out of Chicago? Or, you know, is it SNL?
No, I did Mr. Show with Bob and David.
Right.
I'd gotten to know those guys. They actually came when they were putting the show together. They came to shoot a sketch in Detroit for some reason. They were like, they wanted an industrial place. And director Tom Janis was, he was working with them a little bit. So he's like, hey, I got some people, you know, this cast in Second City. You can shoot some sketches with them. And so I got in touch with Bob and David, got to know them.
Oh, so it wasn't before the show. It was when they were making Mr. When
they
Show.
I think they were doing like a live show in Santa Monica. And they were kind of like, it was the concept of the show on HBO.
Yeah.
But it was a live show.
Right.
So they were showing sketches as they were, you know, performing them on stage.
Oh, so these Detroit sketches were just for a live show.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which they ended up using in the show.
In
Mr. Show, like at. And I think not even like the first season.
Yeah.
But I kept in contact with him and he's like, hey, if you ever want to come out to LA. And then they had some actual sketches that they could use me in. And so I made the move.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because they didn't have like a real, it was all piecemeal when you worked for that show, right? There was no sort of.
A cast?
Cast.
They did. They did.
They did have a cast.
Yeah. I think by the time I came, which is like the last season, fourth season, they had pretty much said, okay, yeah, you know, all these guys are in the cast. And a lot of them
Paul
are writers,
Tompkins,
too.
Paul Tompkins, Jay Johnston. And, mm-hmm. Yeah. Was Marilyn Reichscub?
Not that year, but the year before that.
And Karen Kilgariff? Was mm-hmm. she? Yeah, Karen. Yeah.
Tom Kenny.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, right. Was Jill Talley on it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesus Christ, what a talented fucking bunch that was.
Mm-hmm.
That show's fantastic, yeah.
It was a lot of fun to do. It was a bad experience for me to learn like that way of sketch comedy because I went to SNL after that. And,
right.
Where it's like, oh, they get to do whatever they want. And, and they're doing this like stuff, you know, whatever they're doing is like they're mixing sketches together and they go in and out and they can experiment and all this stuff. And then you go to a show that's like, no, we've done it this way since 1975 and we stay up all night to write and that's the way we do it.
Fit in this box. How long were you in L.A. before you went to New York?
A couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And when you drop into SNL, what's that like?
I mean, you know, I guess everybody—
Was it through McKay? Like, was that sort of your
At that point, I knew everybody, you know.
Oh,
I
see.
You know, Tina was there.
Yeah.
Horatio. I had met with Lorne the year prior. I just happened to be in New York. I was working for Michael Moore,
uh-huh.
who's also from Flint. And McKay.
Oh, for one of his TV shows?
Yeah, for the Bravo show.
Yeah,
McKay
yeah.
hooked me up with him, and we got to know each other, and
uh-huh.
and he started doing this another show on Bravo. He had already done the one on NBC.
Right.
And I was a correspondent.
Uh-huh.
And so while I was in New York working for him, Lauren wanted to meet with me, so I met with him, and he's like, maybe you want to be a writer or something? I'm like, I don't know. So he invited me to the show. To come and see the show. And I was like, tonight? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, how do I do that? And he's like, just show up. So I came to the show, and then he hired me as a writer.
Oh, wow.
The summer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And when do you start doing stuff on the show?
The first show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't think Lauren wanted that, but...
was it like, we need a black guy? If I may be so blunt?
Yeah. Well, the thought was... Tim Meadows was still there
yeah.
when I met with him, and he wasn't sure whether he was going to leave or not.
Oh, I see.
And he told me that. He's like, you look a lot like him, you know, at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, so I don't know if it will work with you in the cast, but, you know, we have writers. We've warehoused people as writers before.
Yeah, yeah,
and
Spade yeah.
and, you know, different
it's
people.
It's so funny that, like, basic shit like that. You look like him, so fuck you, you know.
I thought that anyway. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
you and Tim were friends, you know,
yeah,
from
yeah.
Second City, and so.
Well, you're both very handsome.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. and he's a Michigander, too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, I'd gotten to know him, and I kind of figured that anyway, and then by the time the first show came around, Tim left, and so I'm like, oh, my opportunity.
Aha. And so are you doing regular, are you a featured performer? I don't remember, or are you just a writer that happens to get into bits?
Yeah, kind of in between that.
Yeah.
And then they went
ahead
and
made me a featured performer. Are you in the credits? Oh, you're in the credits.
I was in the credits, yeah. Well, they shot my credit sequence early on. So that's what told me. I'm like, well, then I might as well write a sketch then. I think Lauren's idea was, which they would do a lot of people, like maybe around May, maybe at the end of the season, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
get you in something. And I'm like, yeah, I wrote this thing and I got to be in it. And
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Okay. You'll see how it goes.
Did you had a good relationship with him?
No.
No? Yeah, it's weird because he is sort of like, you know, he was the executive producer of Late Night with Conan O'Brien, mm-hmm. and he's like kind of revels in being a bit of a dick, you know?
Kind of a little bit.
Yeah, he sort of likes it. And I mean, it's kind of funny in a uh-huh. way. Like he came down once because when I say he was a hands-off executive producer, I could print hands-off executive producer on a banner and fly it across the sky, and it would be an understatement. But he came. We had one of our Christmas parties in the studio,
mm-hmm.
and he came down. And it was late, and I mean, like people are smoking weed in my dressing room and stuff. And he came down, and he walked in with like one of his, you know, interchangeable assistants, and or two or three of them. And he walked in, and he went, "Oh, Andy, oh, you're still on the show, eh?" I think I said to him, I said like, yeah, aren't you an executive producer? It's something I think you would know, you know, he could check in every now and then. Cause he came to the first taping, the first test show,
mm-hmm.
and they would set up in our little backstage area, a bar table, a round bar height table,
mm-hmm.
two director's chairs, a bucket of popcorn and an ice bucket with waters in them.
So the same, that's his setup at SNL.
That's his setup at SNL. Yeah. And we had to set that up just in case.
Mm-hmm. Just in case. Always?
Always.
I didn't know that.
It was there for about a year.
I didn't know that.
And I mean, and it was not a very big space.
Right.
It was like in the yeah. middle of this very small space
yeah,
that you had to
was really small.
Navigate around. And I was actually there backstage before a show when our our prop master Bobby Bowman was had set it up, and then he there was something like people were coming and going, and it was in the way, and he went like, and he just said like, you know what, fuck this, I'm not doing this anymore, and he just took it away, and it never was there again. It never got set up again. So, but he's I mean, there's so many people that like Tim Meadows will tell me like
best friends.
Yeah, well, he said he's like I can't say a bad word about the man, because and so many people are that way because he has done so much for so many people.
I can't say. I mean, now I feel like I have a good relationship with him.
To be fair, once I took my son to the show a few years ago when we were in New York, and they asked me to come. Somebody came and said to me, come, Lauren wants to say hi. Mm-hmm. And he was absolutely lovely and gracious, you know. So, I mean, I just think he's a funny man, but his funny is like a very weird, salty funny,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Very peculiar. And he does things. I mean, everybody knows, like, you know, if you ever meet with him, the first time you meet with him, it's going to take 2 hours.
Yes, but you have to. They keep you waiting.
They keep you waiting. Another day. Yeah, the same thing. So there's that. But then there's also he can be very gracious, very very funny, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
he's a very funny dude.
Yeah.
And he knows what's funny, obviously. Yeah. And he's talented. I mean, you know, he's had a show going for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
He also, I'm just remembering too, our debut night, September something, 1993, our first show on the air. And we had a party afterwards at the 21 Club. So I went up to my office like to just like get my bag or something. And on my desk, and this was given to everybody in the staff. It was like a Tiffany desk clock. It was a box, and it was a Tiffany desk clock with Late Night with Conan O'Brien and the date. And there was a card in it, and everybody got the same clock. Everybody got the same note, and it said, "It has been a pleasure working with you, Lorne."
We're getting fired. He's firing the whole show.
Everybody's like, nah, what does that mean? It has been a pleasure working with you.
Oh, no.
And it's just, and I just feel like that's not an accident.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, it's like, you know, congratulations is a lot easier than it has been a pleasure working with you. Mm-hmm. And there's part of me that sort of like, initially was like, oh man, that's fucking mean and weird. And then there's another part of me was like, eh, it's actually kind of funny.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. Yeah.
Since then I've worked with way worse people. You know?
Yeah, so,
four worse people.
Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, who are just outright. Lorne seems just be, just have his own, whatever, you know.
Fiefdom.
Yeah. And it's just a weirdness, you know, that he's always had. And I think it's just because he's comfortable working that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, you know, it's a, you know, how many people are we blessed with in our lives that make us laugh thanks to, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Him going, and yeah, you. Mm-hmm. Yes, you.
Yeah. That's right.
So, yeah. So what happens, is it a good atmosphere while you're working there the whole time? I mean, it seems like, because I know with Tina there, was she head writer at that point?
No. No, she was going that way, but I think Adam was still there.
Oh, Adam. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was like, that was, I think, a new sort of, because when we started in 93, it was not, because I had friends that worked on the show, and it was not a pleasant atmosphere.
Right.
Yeah, yes. Especially for women, I think it was.
Yeah.
Because like, I had women friends that worked on it, and I would hear stories that were just like, oh, fuck, that's terrible, you know?
It had turned the corner by then.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the first things he said to me. He's like, you know, this is a girl show now. So you had like Molly and you know, Anna.
Thank fucking God it's a girl show. Yeah, I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, when we grew up, you know, we watched it. I think it was kind of a boy show. It appealed to like the sensibility of a teenage boy.
Yeah, yeah.
But girls still stay up at late at night on weekends too.
Right.
Home. And it worked out that way when they started doing sketches that featured a lot of the female performers.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The girls started watching more.
Yeah. Well, I always just think the basic thing about, you know, I find this on, like, one thing that I really like about Twitter is how I know there are so many more funny women that I know mm-hmm. about now mm-hmm. and then have ended up getting to know personally because Twitter is kind of like a very egalitarian platform. Yeah. Like it doesn't, you know, there everybody, you just put something out there and it's funny and it, or it's not funny. And it's, and I think that like there's nobody, there's no booker in a stand up club. There's right. no casting person.
Yeah.
It's just, it's, and I've always said, like, it's not like I'm some kind of big feminist ally. It's mm-hmm. just that comedy has been so fucking male
yeah.
for so long that, like, a woman's perspective of being funny is just like, oh, my gosh, mm-hmm. that's different.
Yeah.
And it is different. You know, yep. it's not always different, but it is, you know, it's – and that's why I like – you know, that era of SNL was really – really, really funny stuff, mm-hmm. you know, with Amy Poehler and mm-hmm. Tina there and Molly, you know, it just really, mm-hmm. thank God, you know, because it just, and it was also seemed more collaborative than previous yeah. incarnations of the show.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, they got into kind of the star power thing, yeah. you know, and a lot of the guys, you know, and the girls, even before then, they started to hire people who had already been famous. I think that that kind of was hard for them.
Yeah.
Because right before I came there, you know, they had the Chris Elliott, Jeanine Garofalo.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people had worked a lot, you know, before yeah, yeah. then. And I think that, that it worked out better to get people who were newer to
business, you know. Yeah, and that was also, yeah, that was, and that was rough. That was, mm-hmm. Chris and Jeanine were friends of mine. And mm-hmm. I remember going, because we used to go to the after parties, because mm-hmm. they're like, you know, it's like I, you know, I was in a different class at the same high school.
Right.
So I could get into the party whenever I wanted.
Sure.
And I went once, and Chris is, you know, like, I haven't talked to him in a long time, but we're pretty good friends. Mm-hmm. And I saw him, and he was eating, and I walked up to him, and I said, hey, I saw the show, because we'd watched it at home. I said, hey, I saw the show. It was really funny. And he looked at me, and he went, no, it wasn't. I hate myself. With a big mouthful of food. And I was like, all right, well, honey, I'll talk to you later. You finish your dinner. You know? So,
like, yeah.
Well, so that's like pretty – that's pretty Chris Elliott. That's,
okay.
That's what you want out of your Chris Elliott. Uh-huh. So what happens when – I mean, how do you end?
That
how
year –
How does it end? How do they end it?
That year, I got fired. Uh-huh. Well, my contract ended.
Yeah.
But I was also – by the end of the year, like I said, I'd had this experience in L.A. I'd done, you know, Mr. Show, and I had people in L.A., you know, yeah. and I was always constantly going like, can you come back? You should audition for this. I'm like, I'm doing Saturday Night Live.
Right.
So I felt the pull back. I was definitely going to go back in the summer. And,
yeah, yeah.
And then there was a big to-do with almost half the cast, like if they were going to come back. They wanted to cut the cast. It was a big cast, too.
Yeah.
It's hard to get a lot of airtime in because there was so many talented people. And they let two of us go. They let me and Chris Parnell go. Chris ended up coming back to yeah. the show. I just moved back to L.A. and just started doing yeah, it, started yeah. working. So yeah, that was it. And also 9/11 happened in between that. So I was really ready to get out of New York.
Oh boy. Wow.
yeah.
So you weren't, it wasn't like a crushing disappointment or anything.
I mean, I was mad,
not,
but,
yeah. And I guess it's never good to not be renewed.
Yeah. And everybody was really supportive then, but I was also, you know, I had an attitude too, you know, and I thank myself for that attitude that I had then because, you know, that was really what I think, at that point you're trying to get your identity, your comic identity.
Yeah.
And for me, that's what I wanted to be. And I didn't want to wait. I didn't want to, you know, sit back and wait to be in sketches and I should have left, you know, go and do something else, you know, if I'm going to have to, you know, wait to be on air. So I'm happy about that. And since then, I've gone back and guest wrote. And,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
So, yeah.
So you come back out here mm-hmm. and then sort of what's next? Are you single at this point? Or mm-hmm. you, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't get married up until a couple of years ago.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you still married? You're still married? And
yes. Yeah, so okay. Well, I just got married a couple of years ago.
Okay, okay. Yeah, because I didn't know, because in my notes there was something about you being divorced, but I didn't know if it was
from
the first time. Yeah.
I got divorced right before I moved to Chicago.
Right, right.
So to do – I actually was in Chicago for a year. I was going back and forth in Michigan. And then I moved to Chicago. That's
right. Now, do you think getting divorced, so the way you got married, the way you got divorced, mm-hmm. did that scare you off marriage for a long time, do you think?
No, I think more was that for me, it was just I was just starting to develop a personality. I didn't know who I was. So
yeah,
I started really from ground one.
Yeah.
A lot of ways I feel like I'm 21 years younger until I look at myself in the mirror and I realize, no, I'm not.
No, you're nuts, man. Because it doesn't crack. It's true. It's true.
I'm not 20. I don't look like I'm 32, though. I didn't know that. But, you know, I think it was just it took that time to get a personality to grow up. And when I was an adult in my new life, that's when I knew that I was ready to get married and I knew myself.
Yeah. 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 And so you come out here. Is there any – are you worried like that you're coming out back out here to kind of –
No, I mean, no, that was the thing. It's like things that started to happen for me, you know.
Yeah.
People knew me out here a lot more than in New York, so I was comfortable in L.A. I got to know a lot of people, and I had worked on a few things since the Mr. Show had ended, and so I felt right back in the mix when I came back to L.A. It was where I was comfortable.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good. Were there pretty steady gigs there, or was it sort of like incidental stuff? Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I started working on stuff right away, and at that point there was enough – you know, things to do. I did another sketch show for VH1. I wrote for some stuff for MTV.
Yeah. What's the mix in writing and performing at this time?
I'm pretty much equal.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a lot of stuff at that point that I'm writing too.
Yeah, yeah.
So
much just writing or usually a combo?
Usually a combo.
Yeah, yeah.
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 That's what I wanted to do is I wanted to be out there, but I also wanted to create what I was doing. So I looked for those kind of opportunities.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, but I was also getting stuff where I was just writing, or I wrote for a show on MTV. There was a rap group out of Chicago that made this like sketch show.
Wow. What was it called?
I forgot the name of that group. They did their thing was they did a Shakespeare rap show in Chicago, a live show. And for some reason, MTV was like,
yuck,
let's make a show. No. And that show, I never saw it. And they told me, they were like, oh, you got to come see our Shakespeare show. I'm like, nah, you know, I like you guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I need to have a positive opinion about you.
And they were really cool. I liked working with them. They were, you know, really young. I think they were like in their early 20s or teens, you know.
Yeah. Then. So they weren't like hip hop rap. They were like Hamilton rap.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a lot of the sketches that we did were rap sketches, you know. We say Hamilton rap. They thought they were hip-hop rap, but now there's a difference. Yes,
yes, yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, just you describe that and it sounds like the worst fucking thing in the world. No offense. I mean, you know, it's water under the bridge. Jesus Christ.
I had a
rapping
good time.
Sketch comedy.
There was a couple of shows and I worked on a couple of them.
Yeah.
There were these rap.
There were other rap sketches.
There were other ones.
Oh my God.
All done by MTV.
Wow.
Yeah. There was one, actually, it was right before I went to SNL. There was, I forgot what the, and it was a group of guys then too. And that one was half comedians, half rappers.
Yeah.
And they would do rap sketches and then they'd do comic sketches.
Yeah, yeah.
And the two didn't really meet.
Yeah, yeah.
Although the rap sketches were trying to be funny, but they rapped them. And so they were the rappers were in a different room than the comedian writers. That's how much they divided.
Wow.
But the
wow.
same show.
Yeah, yeah. That's crazy. It's amazing that genre didn't catch on. Really?
I think they tried it. I think it ran its course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so are you... I want to ask you about the duo that you and Craig had, because that, oh my God, when the first time
I think the first time I saw, well, you know what? I know. I think I saw you guys at Largo once. Mm-hmm. And then I saw, it was a bit on maybe some MTV thing on TV.
Oh, yeah. I think there was the Comedy Central Awards.
Yes.
Did you co-host?
I think I hosted them.
Yes, yes. You hosted, and we did it in that too.
Oh my God, so fucking funny.
We did it at Largo. And then, like a week later, we were on Bill Maher doing it.
Yeah.
Because he was in the audience. And it was like we had come up with it like that weekend. Like a couple of days before we did it at Largo.
Yeah.
And
if worked. You, what would one Google to?
You can Google "Somebody's Fucking My Lady." Can I say that?
Yeah, sure. "Somebody's Fucking My Lady" is the name of the song. Oh my God.
"Somebody's Doing My Lady" was the clean version.
Oh.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, and there's a Bill Maher version. There's a HBO sketch pad show they did, and then there's the Comedy Central Awards version.
Did you guys have a whole show that you did, or did it just like incidental?
We did that song because I knew him, and he was taking classes in Chicago when I was in Second City. And I knew him, and I knew that he could play the piano, and I came up with this
amazingly
idea.
Amazingly well. You know.
Yes, he's a really good musician.
Yeah, wasn't he like a musical youth pastor or something?
Yeah. He did like musical stuff in his church, And I knew that he could play, and when I moved to L.A., I kind of lost contact with him because I thought he was still in Chicago, and he was a stand-up, he would tour and stuff like that. And so we had a mutual friend that was a writer's assistant. I was working for the Martin Short show at the time. And she's like, "Hey, I know somebody you know, this guy Craig." I'm like, "Oh, I've been looking for him for 2 years. I got this idea for this song." And that's how long I had it.
Right, wow.
And then we finally met up, and I'm like, "Hey, I got this idea for a song." So we got like super high one night. Started kicking around ideas with him with the and I had the tune in my head, but I didn't have like the whole thing, and so we just kicked it around, and then it was like, "Let's try this tomorrow at Largo."
Oh wow!
And we tried it, and
was it at one of Paul Tompkins' shows or?
It was at that point in time the Monday night Largo show.
Oh okay.
Which would go through different hosts, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
But that was like the cool like alternative comedy.
It was
thing.
Really awesome, mm-hmm. really fun, and such a great little room, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to see you there a lot.
Yeah. Well, like you know, I could walk in the back door,
right?
And, you know, I could park in the back and walk in the back door and not get my car. I can still kind of do that at Largo. I mean, Flanagan, mm-hmm. the guy that runs this club, Largo, is one of the nicest people in the world. Yes. So yeah.
He's very awesome. Very good to us, a lot of people in comedy. And then I've met a lot of people in music through him.
Yeah.
Through that club.
Yeah, there's definitely like a nice overlap of musicians that enjoy comedy and mm-hmm. comedians that are musical. So mm-hmm.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow? When you're doing all this kind of, you know, you're kind of doing different stuff here and there. I always, because I think about the things that, like in me, like the things that I really wanted to go that didn't go. Mm-hmm. I mean, are there, because there, you know, there's jobs and then mm-hmm. there's like, oh boy, if this could happen, it would be so great. And were there ones like that for you?
You were involved in one thing. And I want to thank you. I don't know if I ever got a chance to thank you. I did this pilot for HBO. And
were in it.
And you
were.
And I still haven't seen that, by the way.
Why not?
I mean, I saw it once. I had to go to, because, you know, like, they don't send you your pilot.
Right.
I had to go to the offices. And yeah, I just haven't been able to get a copy of it.
Right. No, I've had the... I did a pilot a few years ago for Fox that I got to watch once. Yeah. The same thing. And it's like, really? What are you protecting, really, you know?
I mean, they probably figured I would put it on the internet, which I would have.
Yes, of course. Why not? So, why not? Yeah, yeah.
That's what Bob did that. We did a pilot for Fox, a sketch show. And yeah, he was selling it for him. Copies of selling it.
Yeah.
But yeah, oh, that's he passed hilarious. It around. And, yeah, yeah, and then, yeah. You know, now everybody's seen it. So yeah. I'm sure they don't like that.
And who is that for? It was for Comedy Central, right?
The one that you did?
Yeah.
It was HBO.
HBO, right, right. Mm-hmm. And what do they say to you?
Well, at that point, it was weird because HBO went through a weird, like, shakeup.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you remember when the guy who, the programming director at that point, got in trouble for beating up his girlfriend in Vegas. You remember that?
Oh, no, I don't remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and so he was obviously over, and then he left, and all the projects kind of just, like, went away.
I hate when that happens. That has happened to me a couple times where there's regime change, and then, like, fucking... Oh, my dog's here. She's protecting us. She's checking the perimeter and barking. Where it's like there's a new alpha male who needs to kill the offspring of the previous alpha male, which is always so fucking frustrating, you know? Because I had a sketch comedy for Comedy Central that a pilot that I was writing for them that I really liked and that. That one stung too, especially because I had been the, you know, number one on the call sheet for three network television shows, Andy Richter Controls the Universe, Quintuplets, and Andy Barker PI.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, okay, I want to do a sketch show. I got a deal with Comedy Central and I'm like arrogant. I'm like, come on. Fucking sketch show on Comedy Central.
Please.
This is a no-brainer. I got this in the bag. And I wrote the first draft I wrote all myself. I wrote a bunch of sketches myself. And then they had Scott Aukerman and BJ Porter come on and kind of help it out because I was going to need somebody to run it. And it was just so frustrating because they were like, oh, it's so funny. It's so funny. But they would – the guy kept telling me, he'd say, like, I don't know why these sketches all live together. Like, what's – they're all so funny, but, like, what's tying them together? And it's like – it's like, well, I'm in them.
Me?
Yeah. I'm in all of them. But, you know, I think that they just wanted – you know, their sketch shows tend to be about one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's like this is the sketch show about – like, there was – I think they had one like – because I used to joke with them and say, I should just do the Bong Report. And I think that they actually did have – yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, a show that's just – everything's about weed, you know, which I was just kidding. And, you know, I should have fucking done it, you know. So, well, tell me about getting married. I mean, were you thinking like it wasn't going to happen ever? Or?
Yeah, I guess, you know, at that point, but I wanted children. I knew that I was like, I think I'm mature enough to have a child now.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Know? And, oh,
how long ago was that?
A couple of years ago.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I started thinking about it like in my mid-40s.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And so I had to find the right person, right?
Right, right, right. Yes. That's important.
Yeah. I think I also, like I'd gone through so many bad relationships and stuff like that. I just learned, you know, like what I wanted. And I'm glad that I didn't get married in between my first marriage and my last one.
Yeah.
I call it my last one because I do not plan on getting married again. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I just know what it is now, you know. And my wife is a wonderful person, a great person. I just found the right person for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just for me.
Yeah.
And maybe not right for anybody else. I don't think anybody else will put up with what my wife puts up with.
Yeah.
We just work.
What
really
do you mean
well
put
together.
Up with? What are you? Just, are you just, moody? Are you?
Anything, you know, it's just me, you know. I mean, I really do think that it's hard for people these days to find people that are compatible because life is so complicated. You can do so many things by yourself, as an individual. To find somebody that is into the same things that you are, that likes the same things you are, that wants to do the same things that you do, has the same kind of passions and goals in life. It's hard. It really is hard. And I feel lucky that I found my wife. I really feel like I fell into it. I fell into, you know, like it's gotten better since, you know, we got married.
Because that's great.
I just was lucky.
How long were you married before you had your son, right?
Yes, two years.
Yeah.
So we had him right away.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah. And what's his name?
Mickey, Michelangelo.
Mickey. Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. And was it scary or were you just mostly sort of excited about having a kid?
Mostly sort of excited. Yeah. I was not thinking about the work and everything. Right. None of that. No, it was just like, okay, I'm married now and I'm in my 50s, so I got to get this going.
And she was obviously okay with that.
Yeah. She's not a spring chicken herself. So,
oh, yeah. Wow. I'm sure she's glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. No, no, we said that at our wedding. Like, these aren't kids going to get married right now.
Right. Yeah. Before the eggs rot, mm-hmm. you better, you know.
Get on it.
Better get on it. Yeah. Well, is there something that you're missing out on that you sort of wish that you would be doing more of? Or, I mean, is there some dream project or are you going to have more kids or?
You know, I'm still thinking about that. You know, now, the fear of me being an older dad and, like, you know, I know. And then I've just met somebody who, like, had their first kid in their 60s. I'm like, what? What are you doing? you know, so that's going away. And I'm also getting used to the fact of, like, oh, it's not as terrible, you know. Like, getting to sleep now, so maybe I might have another one, but I have to do that soon.
It's nice. It is nice to have. Because there's 5 years between my kids, mm-hmm. and for years he was going to be an only child, mm-hmm. you know, because, I mean, you know, I just sort of do as I'm told. so it wasn't really my decision per se. And, you know, and also, too, it's like I don't carry him. Mm-hmm. I don't feed him for the first 6 months or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. I'm definitely a sidekick in that position too, uh-huh. you know? Uh-huh. So when we decided to have another one, it's funny too, because having a boy and a girl, everybody was like, because we knew we were having a girl and people would be like, well, you're all done. Well, you've done it. Yeah. And I was kind of like, well, fuck you, you know, because it's like you don't want to be told what your experience is going to be with your own kids. Mm-hmm. But like within moments of having a boy and a girl, I was like, oh, yeah, this is kind of like a nice complete set here, you know. But I do think, and especially because 5 years was a good spread. I mean, because he was sort of not a baby anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now that they're 14 and 19, they're so close and they have such a really like, they're like each other's favorite person.
Oh, that's right.
And I mean, that's like, you know, it's like the feeling when your kid, you know, like eats a good meal. Like mm-hmm. you just feel like, oh, good. He's just, you know, like, you know, like just this satisfaction that your kids are safe and going to be taken care of. And the fact that they have that relationship to go through the rest of their life.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel like, you know, I could fuck up for a long time and they still would
have
each
other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've got each other and they will have that kind of like incredible, nourishing relationship for the rest of their lives. It's really great.
Did you miss the fact that they didn't go to school together?
No, because actually they did.
Oh.
They did because
elementary you got.
Well, my son went K through 5 to one school and then he came to the school that my daughter was already going to, which is K through 12.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
So
okay.
It's just like it's one of those LA schools that's mm-hmm. like a huge sigh of relief that you don't have to go fucking through that process anymore of looking for, you know.
I just went to orientation or open house for preschool.
Yeah.
2-year-old. Yeah.
And then
I had to go.
Right.
I have to fill out this application to go to this thing. And it was like, when I was there, I'm like, I don't want to buy this timeshare. Because that was what it was like slides. And I'm like, I'm just like lost. I'm like, oh,
what
do you teach them? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, preschool is preschool.
I think so.
You know, it's kind of just, it's,
you're, again, you know, it's like with a dog, you're socializing.
Uh-huh.
You're like taking him, you know, to the dog park to just kind of get around.
Don't fear yourself.
Yeah. And also, too, the important aspect of that is the separation between
yes.
you and them.
Yes.
That's a big deal. You need, you know, it's, you want to feel like, you know, you got a kid and you want to feel like, oh, I want you to know you're always taken care of. But that's not necessarily the best thing. You got to create an individual.
Individual.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
there's more than three questions.
Yeah, no, I know, but I mean, they're all sort of the same topic. Well, let's get to the what have you learned? I mean, what do you, mm-hmm. you know, what's the point of all of this for you? I mean, and it could, you know, it doesn't have to be a work thing. It doesn't have to be a.
I mean, a life thing too, right?
It's,
I feel like I'm at the point in my life now where. I know too much. You were talking about Twitter, and I just deleted my account last week because it was making me so angry. And
yeah.
I think I've learned things of like, you know what? You don't have to do this. If it's making you angry every time you look at it, and usually it's, you know, something political or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you know, just don't do it. Just don't do it. And getting rid of that account, like deleting it, I had the thing, like the screen up to delete it maybe for a week.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm like, okay, if it's this hard, do it.
Yeah.
You got to do it. Like,
yeah.
It's addictive. And I wasn't tweeting. That's the other thing, too. Like, other people, like, they use it. They, you know, advertise whatever they're doing and stuff
right,
like that.
Right,
I wasn't doing that. I was just trolling people. I just get mad and, like, you know, go say fuck off to Donald Trump Jr. or something. And I'm like, that's, and then delete it later. I'm like, just
right,
not do that.
Right, you know? Right.
It's not creating a good life for yourself.
Yeah.
So I think I've learned things like that of like, you know, if I was younger, I probably would have been like, no, I can't quit this. I gotta keep doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I feel I have much better days now.
Yeah.
I'm like getting angry for no reason.
Yeah.
No reason.
I know. I mean, I go back and forth with it because I still do get a lot of good out of it.
I think you do.
And I do. Thank you. And I do enjoy. I like sharing jokes.
Yes. And you, you do that. I didn't do that.
Yeah. See, I like just thinking of silly stuff and putting it out there. And then, and also too, and this is like now that I'm divorced, it's different, but like especially like, you know, being married and having two kids, you know, you're kind of like, you don't do anything, you know, you're just kind of at home a lot.
Uh-huh.
And for me, it was an ongoing conversation with funny people.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them became IRL friends, uh-huh. you know, like, but then there are also people that I talk to all the time who I really do consider like a friend
mm-hmm.
that I've never met.
Mm-hmm.
That I've never met. And that, you know, like I know them pretty well. And I, you know, you're basically, you know, and you're like, it's all brains, you know, it's, mm-hmm. and especially if you're funny and you're a joke person, it's like it's definitely, there's people there that are like my kind,
yes.
my tribe.
Yep.
So I do derive a lot of good from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, it is a good thing. Like it fucking matters when you're trying to sell something.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah. Like if you've got followers, it's a lot easier to sell a book or sell a show or whatever. Because you can say like, look, I can advertise 30 seconds from now, I can be advertising to X amount of people, depending on how many you got.
You got access to millions of people.
And that does matter.
Yep.
But yeah, it does, like I do, you know, as someone who's politically active,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of. I kind of backed off, just this last year's been rough, so I wasn't going to really get down in the mix of politics. And I, you know, and I do a lot of biting my tongue these days just because it's not, there's no, you know, there's, you can't not get shit for say, you say one thing about one candidate and another thing about, and you're gonna get shit from people.
See, you're old enough to know that, like, you know what, I'm not gonna wade into this.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think most of my friends that are in our generation know, like, you know, we're still in the primaries. I'll just see what's gonna happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I see the younger people are like, no, it's gotta be Yang.
Yeah. You
know? They're smart enough to know, like, I'm not gonna, like, ruin this before
the
real deal comes up.
Yeah, and it is like, and how much stress do I need and what am I really doing? Like, that's, I had that thing, you know, because like when I got separated, I really like just unplugged completely from politics. Mm-hmm. I like muted every political person on my timeline. I didn't watch CNN or MSNBC or anything for like months and months and months because I just was under the – look, obviously all my tweeting in 2016 didn't work. You know, I didn't change the world with my cleverness. And B, if I, in terms of like my being informed about the election, which mm-hmm. is, you know, that's the sort of end result. Like right. that's the point of all of it.
Sure.
If I don't, you know, I don't even need to pay attention until like the day before Iowa.
Well, and that's the thing.
And I, you know, and I'll be able to figure it out, you know.
Well, that's the thing. I've never seen so many politically active people in my life until we had social media, after 2016.
Yeah.
I mean, I have friends of like, I'm like, you don't care about politics. And like now you're like a diehard, whoever, Marianne Williamson supporter. I'm like, this is insane.
You know,
but I think that's also the proliferation of social media and people are talking about it. You know, where like I'm like, you don't even care about this, but they do now.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Well, and I think also too, there definitely is a like, sometimes it feels like everybody's a professional wrestler cutting a promo, you know, and that's like, that can be pretty fucking fun, you know, but it just, you know, it does end up being like, it just gets depressing, you know, like to think like just the way the election looks right now, it's just kind of like, oh, fuck. And I honestly don't think Trump's going to win, but it does. But it's like
gets there is going to be so beat up.
It just like seems like such a clusterfuck right now. Mm-hmm. And then you got the whole, you know, and then the, you know, it's like as a depressive, you know, like just when I start to, you know, it's like the fucking world doesn't do you any favors now aside from politics because it's like you kind of start to feel good about everything and then you remember, oh, yeah, the planet's dying. Oh, fuck. You know, like so it just it does. There's so much of it that kind of encourages apathy or like a protective kind of apathy, you know, so. But you can't. You got to do it.
I think it's a thing that we're so connected now, and I don't think human beings were ready to be that connected.
Oh,
We weren't that connected to somebody across the world and know exactly. We were affected by that now. It used to be like, that's a million miles away if Australia is burning. I mean, it's terrible, but now we feel like I'm there. You know? I'm doing a thing, you know, next week, you know, before, and I'm sure that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I also think, too, there's like, there's certainly, and depending on who I mean, this is an incredibly pricky thing to say, but like, there's some people that, we don't need to hear from them. Like, before all that, like, there's a lot of people we hear from a lot now that I'm kind of like, it was better when we didn't hear from them so much, when they didn't have a direct line into my ear, you know, or my eyes.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, there's the good side of it. Like, oh, you get to, you know, keep in touch with people and you can keep in touch with the person's thoughts that you really admire, but also just people that you don't admire. And you're going to hear their thoughts too.
Right.
You know.
Well, now you have a podcast.
I do. I haven't been able to do it because I've been in rehearsal for this show, but I've been doing this cult awareness podcast.
That's a really interesting idea. Yeah. And how many have you done?
About six.
Yeah,
we started in the summer.
Do you talk to people, like, you know?
Try to most of the time. Yeah,
that
yeah.
Have been in. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So the last one I did. I talked to he's a friend of mine. He wrote this book called The Cult of Trump. And he actually helped me out a lot in the last couple of years when I was trying to get in contact with my mom.
Yeah.
Cult expert Steve Hassan. But his latest book, he just decided to look at the commonalities between Trump supporters and he was a cult member. He was a Mooney.
Oh, wow.
And he's helped a lot of people leave cults, so Scientology and Moonies and different other groups. He was the last person. And I also interviewed, which hasn't gone up yet, the whistleblower from the NXIVM. I'm upset I can't remember her name right now. Well, she's an actress.
Mm-hmm.
But she was the first one to talk about she did the interview with the New York Times, and mm-hmm. she got branded, and there was a CBC podcast that featured her. She was the first one to say what was going on inside that whole thing before.
Is that the one in Hawaii?
No, Nexium was nationwide, but it was based on the East Coast. And that was the one that had a few actresses in it, and they were starting to brand.
This. Wow.
Yeah, and there was a big expose in the New York Times, and this guy, Keith Raniere, was the leader of it. And it's a whole story of how it was kind of like a self-help group, large group awareness kind of thing that kind of turned into this thing where the women were starting to become his sex slaves.
Yeah.
And they were.
goes
that way.
It sure does go that way a lot. Oh, dear. So what's it called?
The Cult Awareness Podcast.
Cult Awareness Podcast, and it's wherever one gets one's podcast.
Yeah, you can get it on the Apple, I forgot what it's called, podcast.
Yeah,
but if you just Google it, you'll find it.
Well, cool.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much. And when is your show open? What's it called?
It opens, it's called For the Love of the Glove, uh-huh. and it opens on the 25th. So I think by the time this is out, it'll be running. And it's running at the Center for Inquiry Theater.
Oh, yeah.
The Carl Sagan Theater.
It's Carl Sagan. Is Steve Allen?
The new place. They're a new place now, and they named it after Carl Sagan and his wife. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's actually a really nice space. Nice theater. Yeah,
I guess yeah the
nice
old one, there. That old place is great. Yeah.
This is better.
Oh, cool.
Better, yeah. It's a little smaller. The seating is smaller, but stage and everything is just really nice.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
This is a great conversation.
Thanks a lot.
And, I'm going to check out the witnesses.
I'd rather you to check out the show. Get you tickets.
I'll do that, too. All right. Well, and thank you all for listening. And we will be back with you next week with three more questions. Bye now. Big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.